Alright, well, today we've got Mara. And I'm excited.
You should be. Okay, what I'm going to be talking about, my name is Mara McDonald, and I'm going to be talking about a workshop I attended last summer in Bar Harbor, only because someone had to do it. It was a week's workshop at the Mount Desert Island Biological Lab, and it was the first workshop of its kind on evolution in medicine. And it brought together people from all countries, actually. There were physicians and PhDs, researchers and teachers, and then there was me. And the reason I wanted to go to it, other than it being in Maine, Bar Harbor, was that we seem to have a problem in our outreach for the medical school, and I was wondering if there were any ideas that I could bring home that we might be able to make into outreach projects or do something that would help both teachers in the undergraduate biology sciences are at the medical school level. Now, it turns out that curricula standards are changing for pre-meds, and they are to include evolution. There's a strong evolution component.
Great.
So one of the things I found was that evolution can change medicine's perspective on diseases, possibly improving the treatment options. Or they can possibly remove stigmas associated with ethnic correlations with certain maladies. And I'll talk about that in just a minute. As soon as I find that out. Some questions raised by evolutionary perspectives are, why didn't natural selection make us immune to diseases? Shouldn't we be perfect? Why have rates of heart disease, irritable bowel diseases, and cancer increase in developed populations? And why are there new infectious diseases that spread through the population so rapidly? And I think that all of these questions takes an evolutionary perspective, which is the ultimate factor where versus the proximate factor that you're sick, let's treat it. Now, one of the members of the faculty at the workshop had emphasized three principles in Darwinian medicine. He says, basically, selection doesn't act to promote health or longevity, but fitness, your ability to reproduce. And we'll talk about this in a minute on diseases of aging. Our history, our evolutionary history, impacts on our susceptibility to disease in changing environments. And so we evolved under one set of conditions, and now we're under very different conditions. We'll talk about this with lactose intolerance. Humans now live in very different environments than Paleozoic peoples, but they retain their earlier responses to the original environment, which causes problems. And we'll talk about this in heart disease. In the diseases of aging, and there are many, if you watch me walk, you can see some of them. Genes that enhance fitness for reproduction in the young may be responsible for the diseases of the older folk. For example, there's strong selection for immune responses in younger people who are about ready to reproduce so that they survive and are able to reproduce. But this strong immune response can damage tissues after many years of exposure. So you have a genetic trade-off of sorts. When we move from one environment to another, as Paleozoics did, we have, we're bringing in our whole genome and we're exposing it to different selection pressures. So 70% of the current population is lactose intolerant. And that's the original condition. However, the intolerance, lactose intolerance, is often viewed as a disease state. Dairy products touted as healthy food in populations, even in populations that have high intolerance to them. And aid workers often come from European cultures where dairy products are used as food. And they expect these dairy products to help populations, and they do for the younger individuals, but they're not good for an adult population that's intolerant. And what's interesting about the lactose tolerance is it's the mutant state. And there are two different mutations, one that occurred in populations that moved into Europe and developed animal husbandry, and a second different mutation that occurred in Eastern Africa along with animal husbandry.
Right.
Yeah.
When you said 70% of the population, was that a global statistic or?
That's a global. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. In this country, you would have 70%. I don't think. Now the environments have changed in terms of what we're exposed to. And this has some implications for things like cardiovascular diseases. Dr. Jun Yun was a resident and was perplexed why he lost several of his patients after they were given state-of-the-art treatments for cardiovascular disease. And he reasoned that in the Paleolithic era, predation was the major selection against humans. And that selected for the trauma response, which causes blood clots to form rapidly, blood vessels to tighten to slow blood loss, and inflammation to combat infections. And this certainly was a positive advantage when you're being run down and torn up by a tiger or whatever. But in today's society, we don't have predation as a major, at least in developed countries, you don't have predation as a major culprit of death. But there are other pressures, such as smoking and high blood pressure, can trigger the trauma response, ending in cardiovascular disease. And Dr. Yun also hypothesizes that treatments such as angioplasty and stenting may trigger the trauma response, and he thinks that may have been what killed his patients. Yes?
Do you mind asking? I just want to get a sense of how well supported this hypothesis that atherosclerosis is a trauma response or is analogous to a trauma type response, or is that just a hypothesis right now?
I think that's a hypothesis right now. At least it is with me. I'm sorry. Now, we could go into life history strategies, which are really very interesting in response to evolutionary changes, but we're not going to go very far. We have to recognize that with changes in our environments, we have stable food, we have medicine, and we have access to better health care. Those things that are occurring in developed countries may have unexpected consequences. For example, more food security selects for earlier menses than young girls at a time in our culture when women are delaying becoming pregnant because they want to get started on their career. So you have this tension, cultural tension going on. It's also hard when your 8-year-old daughter is ready to have children. Increased lifespan results in women spending many years in their post-reproductive conditions, such as menopause. And the question is, why is it just women and not men? And moving from hunter-gatherers to modern society increases the densities of our population, which increases our exposure and passing of pathogens leading to epidemics. There are several hypotheses. I was somewhat interested in menopause because there are several hypotheses, including kin selection, that might explain why there is menopause. One is that it's just a consequence of extending lifespans. Depends on how long lifespan extension in human populations have been going on. And the question is, why not remain reproductive during this post-reproductive period? And the answer seems to be that female ova have a given life, a limited life span of about 50 years. And this is true for apes as well as humans. Another hypothesis is the grandmother hypothesis, suggesting that post-reproductive women can help younger women in caring for their young, increasing the success that their genes will get passed on, and that's kin selection. The question is, how long has menopause been an event in human populations? Has our lifespan been extended for long enough to select for kin selection or anything else going on? There's also another hypothesis that suggests that there's gametic competition or generational competition. Gametic competition somehow suggests that the hardier gametes outcompete the poorer gametes, and there are some data that suggests that many of the eggs that women produce or females produce are less than ideal for pregnancies. The second part of the hypothesis is, well, you know, older women who have a shorter lifespan are competing with their younger individuals in the population, and the older women are not as effective at reproducing, especially if they don't live through the upbringing, the raising of their children. There's a correlation with the death of a mother and the death of children 3 years and younger, suggesting that it's the mother and not the father that's really critical to survival in humans, in human babies, infants. Now, one of the models that we've used in some of our outreach has had to do with influenza. Influenza is a virus that we're all familiar with. The virus has high rates of mutation in the antigens in an attempt to escape host detection. And that's true of many viruses that invade bodies. Now, there are two ways the flu virus population can change. There's antigenic drift, which is the slow accumulation of mutations. And from that process, scientists can predict what the next group of flu viruses, what the genetics of the next group of flu viruses might be, such that they can design vaccines against them. The other one is antigenetic shift, and it's the reassortment of genes within species and across species, and they produce really novel viruses that can't be predicted. Genome sequencing, phylogenies, and evolutionary theory have led to better vaccination strategies predicting antigen drift, but not the shifts. Now, I'm getting to the hygiene hypothesis. The hygiene hypothesis basically recognizes that humans have made incredible changes in their environments from the Paleozoic era. Developed nations, and this is only developed nations, now enjoy clean water, clean air, and better health care. And with that, we seem to have a healthier population. With the advent of agriculture, food availability and its breadth has drastically changed. For example, Jared Diamond argues that agriculture has reduced our choices of foods, whereas hunter-gatherers chose a broader array of foodstuffs. Now, these conditions have led to changes in the microbiota, both on our bodies and within our bodies. The human lineage co-evolved with parasites and microbes. And not only humans, but their ancestors have had parasites for millions of years. And as a result, the immune system has been revved up to target these buddies in our bowels, someone once said. When we became developed and cleaner, we cleared parasites from our bodies, and the immune system, but the immune system still remained revved up with no target. Thus, it began targeting foods, pollen, and other non-threatening substances, including tissues in our own body, causing many autoimmune diseases. So the hygiene hypothesis says, if you're too clean and you get rid of your parasites and mutual pathogens, you're going to create a problem because you've got this immune system just ready to grab onto anything, to target anything. And that can lead into other problems for health. For example, in this particular slide on the left, you can see that the rates of infectious diseases have drastically declined. Rheumatic fever, hepatitis, tuberculosis, mumps, measles have drastically declined since the 1950s. In contrast, the rates of autoimmune and diseases have skyrocketed. There's an inverse correlation. We have increases in type 1 diabetes, asthma, multiple sclerosis, Crohn's disease. And this suggests that there's something wrong or something out of kilter with the population in a clean environment. This particular map shows that the type 1 diabetes in the yellow is found in many of the developed countries, high rates, and the infectious diseases are found in undeveloped countries that are in red. The countries that aren't colored have no data for them. But there's an inverse correlation there. In addition, this is something that I found interesting, is that more women tend to get autoimmune diseases than men across many of the diseases. And the question is why? Why are women more susceptible? One hypothesis I've thrown out is, well, is there some sort of difference in terms of the pregnancy immune responses? Does that sensitize women to autoimmune diseases? Over millions of years, parasites and hosts have evolved in response to each other, and there's been this race. As a parasite develops something to overcome the host barrier, then the host develops something to keep the parasite population down. The parasites, it turns out that the parasites we've evolved with have often taken over some of our immune functions as well, early on, to use for their own transmission and development. There's evidence in schistosoma that the initial immune response facilitates infection for this particular parasite. So not only are you having an immune response revved up against foreign bodies, whether they're parasites or pollen, but you're having some of those foreign bodies that have been with us for so many millions of years develop strategies to use that immune system to help them get into our bodies. In addition to parasites, our bodies also house microbes or microbiota, including commensals and potential pathogens. For example, Pseudomonas aeruginosa is common in our water, I think. It's a very common bacterium in our environment. And it doesn't cause any kind of disease unless you carry the cystic fibrosis gene. And then Pseudomonas and some other bacteria will cause biofilm problems within your lungs. Other microbes may challenge our immune systems depending on a number of factors, including the environments we live in. Do the microbiota themselves change with disease states? Turns out that the proportion, this is an example of why you don't want to plagiarize someone's paper. But I didn't have the raw data, so I couldn't do this myself. There are two samples here, colon and small intestine on the right. There are three different treatments. NI is the control, UC is ulcerative colitis, CD is Crohn's disease, and then the two samples to the right of each of those columns are arrived at through statistical analysis. The first is a control subsample, and the second is the irritable bowel disease subsample. And what it's showing is that if you look at the proportion of the different phyla of bacteria in the gut, in the IBD subsample, you will see that Bacteriotes has decreased quite a bit as compared to its control right next to it. Let's see, can we do this? Okay. So Bacteriotes over here, it has squished down quite a bit compared to its control, either the sub-group control or the regular controls. And Bacteriotes is a phylum that is important to us for breaking down complex molecules and keeping pathogens out of our gut. They're mutualistic. The firmicutes at the very bottom are decreased in the disease samples, especially to the right. Firmicutes are important for energy resorption within the intestine. They include things like Bacillus, Lactobacillus, and then they also include Clostridium, Listeria, and Staphylococcus. Actinobacteria change a bit in all of these samples. And they're basically, they've been used for producing antibiotics, so there may be some competition going on with the actinobacteria. And then the proteobacteria have increased tremendously in that right sample in and they are known for a variety of pathogens, including E. coli, Salmonella, Vibrio, and Helicobacter. So with this imbalance of the microbiota in diseased individuals, there's a suggestion that there is something going on. And the question is, well, I think I've just gone over the differences between colon and small intestine, or there are differences for comparable samples in that. There is also a lower diversity of OTUs within the disease samples. There are fewer commensals, and there are increased enterobacteria in these samples. Now, it's not clear whether the disease led to the changes in the microbiota, or whether the microbiota led to the disease. And there's probably a complex interaction going on. There has to be more detailed analysis in terms of what is happening and what leads to one and the other. What can the evolutionary history of parasites tell us about autoimmune disease? Their absence results in increased diseases. Does that say something about what their presence does? And what's really interesting is it's been shown that former parasites or their eggs or juices can ameliorate symptoms in several inflammatory diseases. For example, Schistosoma can ameliorate their eggs, the little guys themselves, or their juices can ameliorate diabetes, experimental allergies, Graves' thyroiditis, and experimental colitis. And these results are from observations in some humans, but mostly with mouse models. Now, one of the interesting things is that people studying Crohn's disease, there was an example of someone wanting to give helminth eggs to people with Crohn's disease to see if it would alleviate their symptoms. And so they took the eggs and they put them in these capsules that we get many of our medications in. And the FDA had a fit. They didn't know whether to regulate them as food or as drugs. It turns out in a very small sample, only five people felt relief. So more work has to be done on what's going on. It's probably a genetic environmental interaction in this particular situation. But as you can see, there are all kinds of really interesting disease-causing organisms that can provide relief in arthritis, diabetes, and other inflammatory diseases. And this, with the animal models, they can eventually take this to the human level, I guess. Anyone want to volunteer? The results suggest that parasites and pathogens can be effective in reducing symptoms to autoimmune and inflammatory diseases. And I think the results suggest that the evolutionary perspective is really important in looking at medical phenomena such as ill health. Evolutionary medicine sheds light on the causes and treatments for various diseases. We, because of our hygiene in developed countries, we've changed our environments with unexpected results, where we've reduced infectious diseases, we've increased autoimmune diseases. With this observation, though, that some of the parasites and pathogens that cause disease may provide remedies for the amelioration of symptoms for the disease, I think is an important insight in evolutionary medicine. But I think there's basically one take-home lesson from these studies, and this is appropriate for the noon hour. Need to eat worms. And thank you for coming. Any questions? Yeah, Dave. David.
Of course. About the last part, the hygiene hypothesis. So I thought about understood the notion in relation to allergy and inflammatory disease. Because I mean, it's the whole system of the immune, it's a whole branch of the immune system that doesn't even have a function.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it'd be perceived that it's probably about intestinal regulative, has a role in the regulative intestinal parasite. But I don't really understand the autoimmune connection. The general autoimmune connection just seems kind of, it's very unclear mechanistically. And I keep wondering whether the correlation people point to worries me, because there's many other things. I mean, so going with development is not just hygiene. It's also, for example, exposure to lots of plastics and lots of potential endocrine resembling, non-natural compounds.
Yeah,
and I'm kind of wondering whether how solid it is that it's about cleanliness. I mean, the most compelling evidence is the stuff you showed at the end about, well, then you can actually ameliorate effects, interventions.
But you can't cure it.
Well, but if that is really, that's the most important evidence, but I'm wondering how compelling that is, because you don't hear about that. I haven't heard much about that.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm done here. So that was nice. One thing though is I think that the messages that were captured in this conference and that we're kind of all talking, we're all sort of hearing from this talk are actually quite dangerous to get out right now, because in the case of the hygiene hypothesis, there's actually the direct evidence for it is slight, and there's actually a very upsetting alternative explanation that makes, in my mind, even more evolutionary sense. So this idea of revving up the immune system, it sounds good when you talk about revving up and revving down, but if you actually talk to immunologists about what revving means, there's no evidence for it, and they're not sure what it would mean. The alternative explanation is that these parasites are immunosuppressive, and they're suppressing the host immune system for their own benefit. So if somebody gets infected with these parasites, the parasites are screwing with the immune system. It might have the transient benefit of making other autoimmune symptoms go away, but they're actually manipulating you for their own ends and leaving you susceptible to all sorts of things. So the hygiene hypothesis sort of has this cult following because it's holistic and it's kind of ideas of revving up and revving down sound really good, and it's, natural diversity, biodiversity is somehow good, but I think thinking about it critically from an evolutionary standpoint, it's probably bad to be infected with immunosuppressive parasites for a number of reasons. So this is, it's I think what Mara presented is a really accurate view of the current state of evolutionary medicine, but I think a lot of the hypotheses have alternative explanations and are really at the point where they're kind of just so stories that could be very damaging if they're promoted as medical truth.
How does that alternative explain the uptick, the trends in autoimmune disease?
Well, the idea would be that autoimmune disease is actually adaptive. That maybe our bodies are telling us that some of these things that we're exposed to, allergens, we should avoid them. And filling ourselves with parasites suppresses those natural reactions, and it's actually bad for us.
So like sometimes why letting the fever run its course is better than taking a bunch of stuff to lower your body temperature.
In what sense is, say, peanut allergies?
So there are confounders here. So there are certainly foreign antigens we haven't been exposed to, and there's other things, like David mentioned, plastics and other things in the environment that we haven't evolved with that might, in fact, be dysregulating our immune system. But for diseases like asthma, that the autoimmune diseases that are the symptoms for which are ameliorated by actually giving these parasites, a perfectly good alternative explanation is that the parasites are simply generally immunosuppressing the host. And that makes sense if you're a parasite too.
So I had heard this all this stuff, but I find it kind of quite tidier in my mind than the simple hygiene hypothesis. Because it does seem to me that there must be relatively strong selection in the longitudinal sense in any species for maintaining an immune system that is primed to respond aggressively and effectively to a threat, but to not be so aggressive, if you will, that it attacks self. And you can imagine the selection is going to keep that. And there's probably always going to be some individuals that in the population where they get the wrong mix of genes and they just end up with autoimmune disease. But if you change the whole population's average immune activity a little bit higher by taking out environmental suppression in the immune system, you are going to increase that proportion of the population that is over that threshold. That makes a lot of sense to me.
It does make sense. So it's not to say that the hygiene hypothesis is wrong, but I think people have gone overboard with suggesting that it's a good idea then to inoculate yourself with a diversity of potentially harmful microbes in order to overcome these effects. I mean, personally, if it was me, I would rather clean myself up, learn more about the immune system, and take a drug that targets that specific pathway in the immune system that's causing me to experience those symptoms, rather than generally immunosuppress my entire body.
Well, you can actually not have to take the parasite, but you can take their their juices that you grind up,
point, which is a good point. It doesn't. I think that that is the hygiene hypothesis. You're just presenting an alternative mechanistic explanation for it, for the hygiene hypothesis. Mm-hmm.
I
guess I have one question now. Could just in terms of one of the basic things that we were looking at with this, which is the uptick in autoimmune disease, couldn't that just be that we can detect them? Or I really don't know.
That is pretty unambiguous.
Well, no, but have we gotten better? No, do you see what I'm saying? Have we gotten better at detecting it in that time period where it looks like there's been an uptick? And before that, we just didn't know.
Before that, we were sick with other things and didn't notice it, even.
Or something like that.
Okay.
And I don't know enough about the field to have any idea.
Detection might be a problem at some point, but I think that where you see the real decline in infectious diseases and the real uptick in inflammatory diseases are after 75 or 80. And I'm wondering if we are able to detect a lot of these much better.
Like asthma is, I guess, pretty easy to detect, and it's in children, so you don't miss it.
I do like your alternative hypothesis, and I think that the point, and this is just a small portion of the whole workshop. I think the point is that alternatives need to be offered out there, and so that they're testable. One result of your particular hypothesis is that the immune system is being suppressed, but in the schistosoma example, it looks like it's being increased, and that the schistosome parasite is actually using it to get into the body. And I can give you the paper on that too. You're probably far better at reading these things and knowing the pathways than I am. I get into immune response and I go and my eyes glaze over. So what I'm encouraging is not to say this is correct or take this home and go eat worms, actually, even though I did encourage that, but to look at these particular examples and ask, how can you, first of all, what are alternative hypotheses, but secondly, how can you use them to teach evolution to biology students who are kind of interested in this gross stuff, and to medical doctors who may now need to start to think about the ultimate causes of diseases. I think that's the take-home message I'd like for you guys to take. Yeah.
Well, related to Tony's point about there being no known mechanism for revving up or revving down the immune system, I'm curious as to what historically is known or if it can be known in terms of human evolution. If there have been not adaptive within lifetime individual shifts in levels of immune response, but whether there have been over longer periods of time population shifts in overall levels of immune sensitivity. In particular, we've had these infectious diseases around for long enough, and humans have been living in dense populations at least for 10 or 20 or 30 generations, enough for a strong selection to have had some effect. Do you know, John, if this?
So we're actually working on this. My student Aaron Sams is working with celiac disease. And celiac is an autoimmune condition that's largely influenced by one HLA type. There's an HLA type that you sort of have to have to be celiac, but is beyond that moderated in risk by a set of now more than 60 other loci, or 60 other alleles at other loci, I should say. And we have a pretty good list. I mean, we sort of know these modulator loci, and we're examining the pattern of their evolution. Question being, celiac is something that's fundamentally mysterious in the sense that you don't want to have a condition that attacks the food that you eat or causes you not to be able to digest the food that's accessible to you. And it's natural to think that what's going on is that there's a conflict between the evolution of these genes related to pathogens and their function in the digestive tract. So we're investigating this. I can say that our hypothesis was that we were going to find that these things were associated with the development of agriculture, in that that probably changed the disease environment in a way that created the conflict. But the result that we're getting is not especially clear. Some of them have gone up, some of them have gone down. Each of them individually is a very minor effect on celiac as a condition, so we don't at all envision that as a target of selection, just as a side effect of what's going on with this system of genes. But the system is heterogeneous in the way that it's changed, I think is what we can say now. So it's sort of pointing to the idea that it makes a big difference where you came from and what alleles you happen to carry and which ones get combined in the same person. So from Tony's point, what I take away is, yeah, the environment has changed, but what we have to keep in mind all the time is that there's this ecology that involves the parasites and pathogens that we're exposed to, but also involves a genetic variability within a population. And one thing that's happened in human populations in this top more mixed ancestry people, where alleles are coming together in people that hadn't historically. Yeah, so you know, my feeling is that there's actually a lot that we don't understand about the way genetic variability contributes to immune response. Yeah, it's, you know.
Can I ask a follow-up? I have to know that type 1 diabetes, there is certain heterozygotes have a susceptibility. Is that true in general for autoimmune diseases?
We don't know in general.
Okay,
we
just that one.
I would approach it with that hypothesis in mind. We don't know specifically in the case of celiac.
So I have a question for the group in general. As a young person who has a lot of friends who recently went to or just got done with medical school, and I talked to them about some of this, and a few of them think it's really interesting. And one or two of them, though, will give me the response, look, they essentially give me the response that makes them sound like a people mechanic, which is, I just want to fix it. I don't really care why it is the way it is. I want to know how to fix it. So, and I know that what you're trying to say is that this perspective can give you some stuff with treatments, but how many hard examples, if you're talking about outreach, how many hard examples are out there that I can give someone that said, look, an evolutionary perspective that actually did help treatment? Because other than that, a pre-med student's going to look at this whole conversation we're having and say it's pretty damn esoteric.
Well, I think that, you know, I think that the question that David raised about the cardiovascular disease example is a prime example. That needs to be investigated. And that is can be investigated by observation as well as direct research. You know, do these processes for fixing cardiovascular diseases actually instigate the trauma response and kill some patients for it?
Yeah.
You know, that needs to be looked at. And that might pique some of their interest if they're going into that kind of work.
The other hook argument you can make for somebody who's resistant to medicine is the argument about antibiotic and antiretroviral resistance. I mean, Thomas talked about antiretroviral escape. He was looking at a patient who's infected with HIV, and then he gave all sorts of stories about how hard the multiple treatment protocols were informed by evolutionary training.
The mechanic analogy seems like you could use that directly. That
was being harsh.
That my auto mechanic understands why something is not working in deciding what to do to fix it.
Pulling parts randomly.
Yeah. I mean, that would be when I've seen cars that have made a noise of this kind, I found that, you know.
Yeah, but then do they really need to know why Toyota put the, you know, the widget here and not here? I don't think they need to know that.
Unless it affects performance, and it may in the long run, in terms of affecting performance or affecting treatment when the widget goes wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I look at it as they don't care necessarily as much why someone decided a cylinder was the cylinder with a piston and it was the best way to do an internal combustion. They just know that's how it is now. I don't know.
I mean, one practical example would be don't give antibiotics if you don't need to.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good one.
I'll say this also, you know, for me, the example that comes to mind is one that doesn't necessarily affect treatment in any way, although it affects perception of treatment, which is ADHD. You know, the major known ADHD influencing gene, DRD4, the influencing allele has a selective advantage in the recent human population. And when you tell patients, you know, or parents of patients typically, tell them this, they're like, thank you, because everybody in my child's life tells me that there's something wrong with them. And evolution is telling me that there's something beneficial about this allele. Maybe we don't know yet what that is, or what its effect is, but at least you're giving me a perception on this condition that gives me information that's not all negative. And I would say to a med student right now, you're going into an environment where in the past, doctors were able to get away with treating people because they're the doctor. And in the future, they're going to be in an environment where people are increasingly skeptical of this sort of stuff. You know, they're not going to do what you tell them just because you're the authority. You need to have actually an explanatory framework that people can work with. And it's not universally the case that, you know, everybody's going to be in that situation. But, you know, the fact is we don't know all the answers about everything. And to have at least a theory that you could apply and tell people, here's what's going on, is much more likely to lead to them complying with what you think they should do.
I'm wondering, John, if there are any comparative studies between, to answer David's question, what are some of the other factors involved in inflammatory diseases? Can you study developed countries and populations that aren't, not in undeveloped countries, but I mean populations that are basically isolated from us.
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely need to have GWAS type studies that are done in non-developed countries. I mean, the fundamental barrier to us understanding what's going on with immunity is that all these tests are done in populations that don't have pathogens or pathogen load anything like what's normal in our recent history.
But I'm wondering if studying a hunter-gatherer society, if any still exist, would tell us what the normal microbiota might be.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. This work is being done.
Okay.
Yeah, there are people studying that kind of thing.
Okay, good.
Like metagenomics and aborigines.
Yeah, sure. Uh-huh. Yeah,
that's cool.
Now, Chris.
So we also pamper our domesticated animals. I'm thinking particularly cats and dogs, and livestock. Do they have a similar shot up in autoimmune disease?
You know, I don't know. Right now I'm nursing a dog that pulled her her ACL and had to have surgery. So I feel like anything that I've done, she can do. And she's doing it. But I'm not sure about other diseases.
There's a change in our around there.
Actually, yeah, some do.
Yeah, but I mean,
livestock, though, live community.
I think 10 years ago, if your cat was puking all over the floor every day for weeks, you would just put it down.
Yeah.
I don't try to figure out.
I thought that was normal, though.
there are trends in
normal chicken.
Yeah, parallel human trends, specifically with cancers and precancerous conditions like the thyroid adenoma in cats is on the rise, and nobody knows why. Some same types of trends here.
So there might be emerging animal models.
Actually, there's an interesting tie with people who study allergy and asthma have found that if you are raised in a family with a dog, then you have a lower tendency to develop asthma. And this actually, so it might be the priming of the immune system.
It actually is true for some of the irritable bowel disease as well.
I was wondering if there's an angle on this where it's a revving down in the immune system rather than a revving up, that as you're developing as a child, if you're not exposed to sufficient pathogenic load, then you're not trained and you go off and you're going to be more susceptible. Is there an aspect of the hygiene hypothesis that because we're so clean now as kids, our kids are so clean that they don't see what they should see to get a really good boost as they're developing?
I can't.
No aspect of that.
Yeah, I can't respond to that specifically, but I do know that there have been observations that that children raised in households with pets have lower incidences of some of these diseases, including irritable bowel, that farm children, or children raised with sibs have lower incidences, and farm children have the lowest. So that there is a connection, I think, between exposure to multiple antigens. And
so has anybody looked at any incidence of autoimmune, it's probably impossible, autoimmune diseases in populations of some wild animal? Like, go out and look at the Yellowstone moles and see if they have autoimmune problems.
Well, they're probably being shot before they have.
Well, there's that.
Well, yeah, autoimmune diseases are almost start out in the subject, in the patient. They're viewed there, and you can't. If you walk around coming down with an autoimmune disease, you don't have a fever and rashes, but nobody notices. You have to start noticing yourself, and then perhaps to some extent, as you keep noticing it, it seems to get worse. Anyway, you go see the doctor, and you wind up with a diagnosis of an autoimmune disease that, for one thing, a few generations ago, you might not have lived long enough to have. If you did. But there's something subjective about most of those autoimmune diseases, I think, it seems to me.
Autoimmune disease is sort of a garbage diagnostic category.
Well, yeah.
And in fact, I mean, the argument here about atherosclerosis, the epidemiological data suggests an association with infection with chlamydia pneumonia, a common bacterium. So it might not actually be autoimmune, it might be immune.
Yeah.
And there might be plaques, maybe the result of infection with a microbe. So there's autoimmune is usually the last checkbox.
That's a big topic with rheumatoid arthritis too.
Yeah.
I was just thinking there actually is one that we know a lot about in skeletal paleopathology terms, which is arthritis.
Yeah.
And there used to be really high osteoarthritis that has really declined, and most arthritis today is rheumatoid. That used to exist in any significant way.
I just remember one thing, and I was winding down. I was recently arm twisted into serving as an editor for a journal that's going to be coming out hopefully with the first issue in 2012 called Evolutionary Medicine, Journal of Evolutionary Medicine.
Oh, yay.
So there's going to be a new journal. And I think, from my experience with two journals, we'll be desperate for new articles. So
you can get a lot of
contact me, and we'll see about the inaugural issue.
Yeah, you can get a lot of opinion from this group.